Yeah.
All right, well, let's call the roll here, even though we don't have a quorum yet. Just not hold anybody up.
We have no action items.
How you doing? Good. How are you?
Colin,
good.
Rachel. Okay, Bruce Bastian.
Mr. Gonzalez is here.
Tomas Boynton. Terry Brown.
Here.
Judy DeVersa. Greg Fagan.
Here.
Michael Fitzpatrick is excused. David Flanagan. Richard Gonzalez.
Here.
Glenn Harvey is excused. Tino Pena is excused. Andrew Thompson?
Here.
And Myra Newman?
Here.
We have a quorum. From nobody's said that from up there.
We have a quorum.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we had six and then he said present, yeah.
It's all right, man.
We have seven.
We need seven.
We're four. We need seven.
Was that six?
Okay, do we have a consensus to adopt the agenda until we have a quorum?
Sure.
Okay, consensus. Seeing a consensus, we'll move forward. I'll come back to the minutes when one of the other members show up. Comments from the chair. I'd like to welcome Bill Klein, who is a proposed member waiting for the formal confirmation vote that's sitting here today. Thank you for coming and getting a feel for it. And welcome.
He can sit at the table, even though he's not a regular member.
Space.
If you'd like to, unless.
I'll wait until the other people get here and see what seats are left. How many more do you have coming?
Two.
Judy said she'd be late.
We have two that are.
Nobody sits by me.
Watch
this. I mean, the new guy doesn't know yet.
Okay. CC liaison report.
So you should have a printout in front of you, the liaison report. I'm just going to read off the first three here, and then you guys can look at the other ones. But the month of May, so this month, is the South Florida Commuter Challenge. So all the counties in the South here, the partnership with DOT is promoting alternative transportation to work. So you can go to that website, and they have an app you can download to log your miles for alternative modes. And there's a lot of businesses that are also using that this month. There's going to be a road impact fee workshop that the MPO is scheduled coming up here, and so basically with that, stressing the current road impact fee and boundaries of that, and questions have come up about how we can allocate that funding and the flexibility of that funding. So that's what that workshop will be covering. And then this year is the MPO's 40th anniversary, and we plan on having a commemorative celebration on December 14th, governing board meeting. And our first official meeting occurred on November 10th of 1977. And you can read the other ones on that short time.
Is there any update on the what we heard before about the MPO and the county sort of separating themselves in terms of this anniversary?
There's no formal action to give you an update. We've continued to talk about it with some of our municipal members, but I haven't gotten clear direction from the MPO board to pursue it. I guess the one thing I'll make you guys aware of is we have an interlocal agreement between the MPO and the county whereby we're allowed to be hosted by the county. It had an initial five-year term that expires in September of 2018, and if we want to extend that beyond the end of that term, we have to let them know by September of 2017 that we want to keep going. So we're getting close to the date where I have to send them a letter saying we want to re-up but we're not, and we're going to be asking the board to do a more focused evaluation of their options.
When you say host, other than provide great offices, what does that mean?
So there are two parts to being an MPO that need to come from local government. First, we are funded federally. The
majority of our dollars are funded federally. So our planning staff, our consultant budget, even the rent that we pay the county, which we do pay, is a federally reimbursed expense. But the key word there is reimbursed. So in order to be an MPO, you need to have somebody who provides you with the cash to spend first to develop a list of expenses and submit an invoice to the federal government and say, please give me the money back. So we need a float. The county, as the host, provides that cash flow management float. The other thing is our Federal Transit Administration grant requires a 10% match to come from local sources in order to get the federal money, and the state kicks in another 10%. So my agency's budget is, $900,000 from Federal Transit Administration on an annual basis. So I have to get $90,000 from someone locally. Right now, the county, as the host, has agreed to give us the $90,000, right? We'll be passing a hat to make sure that local funds will be available. So it's a match for the FTA grant, and it's a float for both the Federal Transit FTA grant and the Federal Highway, or FHWA grant, that funds our operation. Those are the two things that the county provides. In exchange for that, though, they've exerted, they have an interlocal agreement that says all of our employees are county employees. The MPO is hired, sort of, by a process that is reviewed and consented to by the MPO board, but ultimately is approved by the county commission. The MPO director, me, can be fired by the county administrator or the county commission without consent of the MPO governing board. So there's a little bit of a weird dynamic there.
And all the employees have the benefits and protection of the county, county employees?
It gets very nuanced. But yes, we share the benefit structure of the county, with respect to personnel benefits, sort of insurance and time off and whatnot. But the MPO employees are considered at-will employees, so they're somewhat distinct from run-of-the-mill county employees who are allowed to grieve like if you were reprimanded for some
very wrong form.
There's a process to follow.
Yeah,
so MPO employees, in order to let the director have a little bit more independence, are able to be terminated without a process. The problem that we run into with management of those of the employees is that I have that ability, so I have sort of a hammer, but I have no carrot. If I want to give my employees a raise for outstanding performance, I have to go through the county approval process, and the county's answer every time I've asked has been no. So it's one of those weird dynamics where they're exerting some influence over MPO day-to-day operations as the host that maybe.
And if I may ask,
then
your employees are under the state pension system too?
We are.
That's a pretty big carrot right there, if you ask.
So, sure. So yeah, we could do that as an independent MPO as well.
Oh.
That's a carrot that we could offer in either situation.
Okay.
You belong to the union?
No, employees don't want to be union employees.
You have a union in the company?
Any ideas?
Yeah. The only one that I'm aware of is the Amalgamated Transit Providers Union.
That's already a deal with those guys every day.
Yeah, so the transit, the bus drivers.
Bus drivers.
Yeah.
And the .org domain. The MPO, you regard yourselves as not a government agency. Is that the idea?
That's a weird distinctive. I don't know if .gov or .org is that's more of a local branding question than this. What flavor of entity are you? I mean, Palm Beach County is a .org. It's pbcgov.org. So. Hmm.
City of Boca is done. So it's all over the map.
So, but the issue, your issue really is personnel issues.
It's governance, and the reason it's governance is a general statement is because while it has not happened, the situation has occurred in other MPOs in Florida where they were hosted by one of their members. And the member manager went to the MPO director and said, I know the board told you to adopt these priorities and fund these projects, but I want you to do these instead. And if you don't, you'll lose your job. And it's that kind of undue influence that a governance structure will protect you from or make you vulnerable to. And I think that's what we're trying to debate, really, at the MPO. Now, again, no demons in the closet right here. That hasn't been an issue, but that's why the conversation came up initially, was we want to establish a clear chain of command for the MPO board to direct the agency.
Well, that decision has to be made by September of this year, and then December you'll have your 40th anniversary, so the anniversary party would be calling.
Very well. Well, I should mention, the other thing we're doing right now is...
I'm going to invite them back.
You know, and regardless of whether we're hosted or separate from the county, the county is the largest member entity within the planning area. They are providers of countywide service. They are owners of more lane miles than any other entity. So the county, you know, they own a lot of county roads. They provide the transit service. They are an essential partner in transportation planning. So it's really a question of governance and philosophy, not of relational discord. I'm trying hard to walk that line and say this is, it's just a discussion about how should we be organized.
Yeah, the danger goes back years ago. I don't know, go back 20, 25 years ago, there was a 5-year road program oversight committee that would review the road program, and money was coming in, and if it wasn't spent, the money was being basically hoarded. So it came up to light at a certain time, like, wait, whoa, you got the $60 million coming a year in, and you got this $120 million windfall, and you're keep raising the rates, raising, you're not spending the money that you're supposed to be saving, you're hoarding it in the slush fund. So it came to light before the commission, they didn't like it, and they just abolished the 5-year road oversight overnight. Boom. So there's some benefits to having some independence where the cities have a voice and the county can't strong arm as we go forward. So it is a true independent transportation, and you keep the politics out of it, you keep the mission solid. So anyway, all right, let's move on the agenda, unless you want to get...
I just want to make one comment about number 4 on the list, the bike rodeo. I have never been to this bike rodeo, but I lived in Davis, California for 4.5 years, and they have the most fabulous bike rodeo in the world, and they have for years. If you Google it, you'll see the most remarkable bicycles. It's really wonderful.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay. Next on the agenda, is anyone here from the public that would like to speak today? Seeing no hands raised, I will move on and close that portion of the meeting. Information items. Item 2A, the Transportation Improvement Program.
So in your packet, you should receive the first reading of this, and it's the executive summary of the TIP for this upcoming fiscal year 18 and 22. So this is that May draft. We're currently in the public review process now, and this is going to be going on all the way until June's board meeting, until they approve it. So if you haven't been able to review it all right now, and you can look at the next version that will be presented here in a few weeks. So you still have tons of time to comment and provide some feedback, and we really would like some feedback on if it's understandable and how we can improve it. So this is really what this is about. This is going to give you a little introduction to it. So basically, we're right here over in May for this draft TIP, and like I said, the final TIP is going to be presented in June. And we expect to have, even though you're seeing an executive summary in the packet, and I'll present on that a little bit today, the full document should be ready for our board committee in 2 weeks. So keep on lookout for the larger document itself, so you can read through the whole thing. And then, of course, it'll be operating under the next fiscal year after that's adopted, and starting in July. So the purpose of this, of course, how easily is it understood by the public and by our committees. Also, what kind of improvements can we really make to this document to make it more easily understood? And then, are there different projects that are missing, or how they're described that could be better shown?
And then we'll be looking at some upcoming construction projects and then other program projects that we have coming up. So basically, the document is very similar to what we've had in the past for the last TIP, or our current TIP. The only changes really is we're adding a section Sun Trail project type, and then we're changing the section of MITRE projects to just say other FDOT local projects instead. And if you're wondering about which project listings we have by types, you can see them in that first page afterwards. You can see them all there. So we have our strategic intermodal system capacity projects, major MDO projects, and we'll be going through a few of them. And then the next page, of course, gives you a little bit more of a description about what those all are. And I'll go through a few of them today. So if you keep going through your packet and you see the pages, you'll see different major tables here, major MDO projects, and it keeps going through a summary of all of the projects. So a few I want to point out. So major projects, the 5-year is around $200 million of funding, and right now what we have programmed for this draft is $126 million. And the reason for that difference right there is due to one of the projects, mostly, is this Tri-Rail extension, and we're waiting on DOT to start the design phase again. And you can see that in the table there. So there's another, right now it's an estimated $73 million that would take up funding somewhere within that TIP range for programming. That would really push us closer up to that $200 million. And then some other highlights from this section. Last time around we hadn't allocated construction to Balwell Road yet, so that's been allocated. The same goes for Atlantic Avenue, construction fiscal year 21 is allocated. And then I put on here US 1 study. So one of them in here is the US 1 project going from Camino Real to Indian Town Road. So most of the length of the county. And we're actually starting to kick off for that US 1 multimodal corridor study pretty soon. And we'll have some information on how to get involved in that and what's in the details of that later on this afternoon. Local initiatives. So the local initiatives program is a competitive process that we do annually for applicants to submit some local projects. And we have a specific set money aside for the strictly this program. And our 5-year target right there says around $85 million. We had some leftover money from before, and that's why you see the increase there of $93 million of program for fiscal year 18 and 22 in the TIP. And basically how this works also is some highlights to give you is we just went through our process again for new projects people applied for construction in fiscal year 23. So that's right outside the TIP window, and those will be approved in the next few months here. Well, we usually set aside a little bit of money in for years around fiscal year 20 and 21 to have design of that, and then construction in 23. And if you look on the table in your packet here, under local initiatives, the last one you'll see on that page is a reserve box, and that's on page 10. The last line you'll see there is a reserve box, and you can see in the outer years, fiscal year 20 to 22, we have some leftover money there. So that's where that usually falls in. So this next round of projects that we have for fiscal year 23, you can see that we still have some reserve funding in 22, a big chunk there of $16 million. So even though we tentatively have them programmed most likely in fiscal year 23, there's funding available, so a lot of times those projects move up a year. Transportation Alternatives Program is another competitive funding process that we also have here at MPO, and it's going around the same timeline for applying as the local initiatives. And you can see there the 3-year target, $9 million program. And then how this is all these projects have been funded in construction currently. Three of these are starting construction around August, September of 2017. And then we have 5 program construction in this year, 2018. And I also wanted to point out in your table here that even though we're showing the projects, you can see for a lot of these pages, you'll see funding that's been allocated before fiscal year 18 and there's no funding in the TIP for, because the project's already going to construction. Well, we wanted to keep it in there for the time being, even though we don't have any money programmed in our TIP for those years, because we wanted to stay up to date until it starts to go into construction. So once it actually reaches construction, that's when we start keeping it out of the TIP. The SunTrail program, so we only have one project right now, and this is a new set of funds that is meant to be used to establish a statewide trails network for non-motorized trails in coordination with DEP's Office of Greenways and Trails. And it's kind of hard to see on this map, but those are all the areas that you can see kind of highlighted there on the road network that funding is eligible for. Right now, we only have one project, and that's the US 1 conversion of four-lane roadway to two-lane roadway from 25th to 42nd Avenue. And that's made, of course, shared use non-motorized trail median, what the program is meant for. So. And let's go on in some highlights about upcoming construction projects. The list in your the table will be larger than what you see up here. And I just had some larger ones on there, funding-wise, coming for fiscal year 2018. But like I said, and this starts on page 14, there's a lot more that you can see there. Turnpike widening, you see there north of Boynton Beach to West Palm Beach. Resurfacing on SR-80. Resurfaced on I-95, that Northwood Rail connection from CSX mainline to FEC mainline, and then I-95 interchange at Atlantic Avenue, adding some additional lanes.
So can I ask a question?
Yes.
In the major projects, there are projects that are listed for construction in FY18 that don't appear on this.
Correct. That's a good point. So these are other projects that aren't already being shown in other sections. So yes, that is correct. So what he's referring to is the major projects will have, that will say construction going on as well for the fiscal year 18. So it's a better title for this should be like other construction highlights. Yes.
I think, you know, from the public's perspective, it would be useful if all of the construction projects for a particular FY18 were on the same thing.
Okay.
I mean, you know, otherwise you have to look in two different places, you have to read this, you read a little note on the side, and how is the public going to know what's going to go on next year? So I would just suggest that if you're considering improvements in the presentation, that anything that's going to be constructed in FY18 ought to be on the FY18 construction list.
Thank you. Yes, and that's exactly the kind of feedback we'd like. Okay, great. Any more questions or comments on this one? Okay. And then this portion is significant changes. And this is from fiscal year 17-21 to the new TIP draft, and that's 18-22. And this starts on page 15. And you can see these projects here. I highlighted the major ones for the interchanges and the turnpike widening. So for the interchanges, you can see the advancement of PE funds, changing years there. And then for the turnpike ones, they were initially programmed in earlier fiscal years, and they have been moved out to later fiscal years, either 22 for construction or even outside the TIP window, so after fiscal year 22.
Question?
Yes.
I noticed that the turnpike's a separate authority, or enterprise under the DOT. You're including it with the regular MPO projects?
In the TIP, we're trying to show every single project we have going on in the county. The project itself, when you see the product pages, of course, will show you the funding, and so you know which ones are really where the funding's coming from. And then when it comes to the major MPO table, MPO project table, that's our priorities right there. So yes, it is a separate pot of funds that we only have oversight over in that regards, as in being an MPO priority project, but we still try to show it.
already asking again, are the turnpike projects under construction in FY18 on the table for FY18 construction? I didn't look at that, but.
I think I did see all of this. So on page 14, we have the turnpike project second row there.
Yes, I see. Yeah.
And then there's a few other ones that are
right.
Not widening, just some other small turnpike ones,
yeah.
Like, but resurfacing.
Good.
So that major one there is there, correct. That turnpike one, you can see there are 155 million. Construction fiscal year 18. So. This is the last slide I have. So what's still left to do? So we need to finalize. I'm putting in all the local projects that we get from the jurisdictions. So basically what happens is we have, of course, DOT has a large work program. We have all their projects that we put in there. And then we try to provide better descriptions when we can. So if you ever see descriptions that are confusing or that don't really make any sense, you're not really getting anything out of it. We want to update it to make sure it's understandable to everyone in the committees and the public so they know what's happening at that project. So we take all those, we take all the local projects and transit projects, and we'll put them in. So I still need to update a lot of transit local projects. And then, of course, all the comments and edits that you all have, that the public has, in the various committees, we'd like to incorporate those. So, for example, construction list that you just mentioned about putting them all in one location. We had some feedback from the technical committee earlier today. And then providing complete documents. So we're going to have the entire document ready for the board committee coming up here. So we'll be able to have that to you all to view as well.
What change did the TAC suggest?
Sure. They were wondering about how we can better show the progression of projects in the long-range transportation plan into the TIP. So they're struggling with seeing that connection right now. And so maybe providing a way of a breakdown of more of the number of projects by type or also the cost, just a way to get at how many of the LRTP projects are actually being implemented.
So we'll be developing a scorecard that will kind of identify total number of projects in the LRTP, and then how many were contained in this five-year TIP, so we can kind of keep track.
That's a very good idea. Yeah, there's some visual presentation.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that was
even if it's redundant of what's in here, it would be useful. Because after all, you know, most people can't or won't read all this stuff, particularly online.
Yeah, so trying to paint that picture in an easier way. That's definitely our goal. So, but a full document we're trying to get done by pretty soon here because the board meets, looks like, May 18th. So we'd like to have a full report for them to view then. So, and of course, their final adoption is June 15th of 2017. So, and we'll be taking comments throughout the entire time of that. And then we'll be mapping the projects by construction year this year to see how that looks and turns out. So all these projects will be mapped. And that'll be in the TIP document. And we're still working on our interactive map to make that a little more useful for everyone to see the projects. And of course, public involvement process, like I said, it's more about getting public comments and integrating those as well into the document.
So we'll see this again in June, right?
Correct. Yeah, this is just really preliminary
right.
Information. Really wanted a lot of feedback on the structure of it and if it's easy to understand and what can we do from that. I think that's all I have for that.
Good. Anybody, your members have any comments or questions? Yes,
I sent an email to Nick the other day asking him a question to try to better understand the flow of work and all this sort of stuff. I'm sorry, he stepped out. He said he was going to address my questions today. But here's it goes back to my favorite project, where in the last TIP, scheduled for construction in FY17, and Nick told us that, I asked
your question.
Here he is.
I'm here.
So the construction was scheduled in last year's TIP, it was scheduled in FY17. And if I remember correctly, and you can correct me if I'm incorrect, you told us that if the contract were let in May, then that's sufficient to be able to spend the money. But if the contract's not let in May, the federal money goes back to FDOT in Tallahassee, which can then reallocate that federal money to any NPO in the state, wouldn't necessarily come back. So the real question was, how realistic are the projections of when a contract is going to be issued so you can actually spend the money? Because if you can't spend the money, then it would be better off to allocate those funds internally to other projects that are ready. You know, we delay projects, put something in the budget now, and if you can't spend that money now, you're at risk losing it. Why wouldn't you instead allocate it to fund projects that are closer to fruition? So now that particular project, the construction money is listed as before FY18, and construction in FY18, I don't know whether the contract's been let. Is that your case?
So there were a lot of statements in there.
Yeah. Well, I'm waiting for you to explain it to me. I've got to learn this stuff.
I can't just say yes or no.
Yeah.
Let me try to... Is it okay if we talk about this for a couple minutes before we do the next item?
Well, yeah. Yes.
All right. So let me try to engage with this issue. And I'll do it with an example. So first off, a flat statement. Federal funds given to the state of Florida are use it or lose it. So you need to be ready to obligate, not necessarily expend, but obligate, meaning you've encumbered and said, we know what we're going to use, and we've got a federal highway to agree it's a good idea to use the money for that. It's consistent with all the checks and balances. But you have to obligate every dollar available to you. Otherwise, in June, July timeframe, the federal government does a rebalancing and says, which states have more federal aid eligible projects than they have money? Because Florida couldn't figure out how to spend all their money and we're willing to give it to someone else. Now, on a national basis, Florida is great at getting money from other states because they have built in a program where they spend more state money then they expect to get back from the federal government in a rolling fund and say, we're always going to be oversubscribed. We're going to spend $110 for every $100 we think is on the table, just in case one of those $110 doesn't materialize. That way, when other states say they don't have money, we can say, Florida has, we've spent $110 down here. Why don't you give us $10 more of federal aid and we'll benefit statewide from that inefficiency in other states. So they've built that into their statewide practices and don't ever leave a federal dollar on the table. They win in that rebalancing conversation that happens every year. That being said, there's still a question locally as to whether we're programming every dollar appropriately or not. The one thing you said, so it's in the May-June timeframe that this rebalancing occurs. Because the federal fiscal year closes out in the end of September, and they want to make sure that they've given away all the money that they were given from the from Congress by September 30. The one other thing that you said is that if the money is not spent in Palm Beach County, then it goes somewhere else in the state. That's not exactly true. The intent, and this is where I'll illustrate this concept with an example. State Road 7 from Okeechobee Boulevard to 60th Street. In our fiscal year 16 TIP, was supposed to spend, I just pulled the numbers, $14 million of federal money to widen the existing section of State Road 7 that the county built several years ago from a two-lane road to a four-lane road. The state couldn't get the permits from the Army Corps, or from the Water Management District. So they couldn't let the contract, they couldn't spend the $15 million. What they did with that money instead, the $14 million, they bumped the $14 million from fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 17, and they took the MPO's desire to invest in a tri-rail layover facility that was funded in 17, and they moved that to 16. Because that project could actually receive the money in fiscal year 16. So they did rebalance, but they did it within the county, and further, they did it within the MPO's major priority list. They said, you have another priority that we can advance, this one moved back. That being said, Myron's question is a valid one. Are we programming money consistent with when projects can use it? It's a bit of a guessing game on a project like State Road 7 because the Water Management District issued a permit, and you have to sort of assume when you're in the construction industry that when you get a permit, you get to go build a project. And then if someone challenges it and has to go through litigation, then that's an unexpected delay and you have to let it run its course. Now that delay has run its course. The judge has decided to uphold the Water Management District's permit issued for the State Road 7 project. DOT is still waiting for a Corps of Engineers permit on that project, but they believe they can obtain that permit in the time frame that's being shown to the MPO, and they're saying, we think we can spend the money. So now we get into a subjective decision as to whether or not a city's objections and challenges will actually delay a project long enough to warrant reallocation of funding. So far, DOT says, trust us. We think we can get the permits we need, and we want to build this project. But if they don't, the reason I wanted to show the fiscal year 16 example is, if they don't, then I think their commitment to us is, we'll bump the funding for your project with unexpected delays back a year, and we will accelerate one of your other priorities forward a year to offset the impact. So I don't
Which
think
is desirable. It's desirable.
I don't think that's
when in the year do you have to make those decisions?
It's right about now that's happening. So the DOT is looking closely at the State Road 7 project, which has a lot of money in fiscal year 17. I think the fiscal year 17, the north piece has $50 million from 60th to North Lake. The south piece has $16 million from Okeechobee to 60th. So, you know, $66 million is on the line. And what we want to either spend that on this project, knowing that we can award the contracts and get it going, or we're going to have to accelerate some other project and delay that a year. So that's happening right now. That's not necessarily the type of thing that we do at the MPO, though, because we're trying to plan, prioritize, and fund, and then leave to the department the permitting and the balancing act in the first year of the work program as to where they need the money and what they have to balance to.
And when if schedules do change as a consequence of the decisions that are being made, then when does that show up in the TIP?
Right now, the assumption that the TIP is making is that those two projects, and I'll keep on that example, the State Road 7 projects will be built with the fiscal year 17 money. If they can't be built in that time frame, then what we get in September is called the Roll Forward Amendment, which is basically the DOT saying, we did our darndest to spend the money by June 30th, they can go on a state fiscal year. We couldn't do it for these projects, and we want to bring these dollars forward into fiscal year 18. So you'll see it in September. What they won't show you is what they ended up spending money on in 17. Instead, we give you that information in December when we sort of do the final reconciliation of the prior fiscal year and say, this is where we said we were going to spend money, and this is what we actually spent money on. And we presented that to you last December, and I think we highlighted that State Road 7 didn't get money, and that the tri-rail layover facility did get money, and that was different than what was in the TIP. And we're trying to bring all this together. It's hard to do it all in one meeting and connect all the dots with a project list as long as ours, but we're doing our best to make it understandable and sort of simplify it for you and for us, frankly, because it's hard to keep track of all this stuff.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful.
Thanks. Any other members? Let the record please reflect we have a quorum. Okay. This one. Any other members have any comments on item 2A and information? Okay, seeing none, move on to the next item, gas tax transportation funding.
Chairman, should we approve the minutes since we have a quorum before?
I'll come back at the end here so we can get through that.
All right. WD.
So this is the high level
overview.
I'll say two things about this. First, I appreciate when you ask questions like this because it makes us do more homework and understand the system a little better. So keep asking. It help us make sure we're giving you useful information. And then the second one is there's going to be a lot of rabbit trails that we can chase in this discussion. And it will help us, if you find one that is particularly of interest to the committee and you want us to chase it in a future presentation, let us know what that is. This is more of a big picture, how does the system work? So we're looking just at fuel taxes, a focus on fuel tax revenues, but we're talking in general about transportation funding. Where does the money come from? Well, it comes from fuel taxes, it comes from motor vehicle licenses and title and registration fees. It comes from user fees, whether you're paying to drive on a toll road or you're paying to ride on a bus, that's a user fee. It comes from developments paying road impact fees. So every time someone pulls a building permit in Palm Beach County, they write a check to the local government saying, here's my impact fee. On the transit side, I mentioned it comes from user fees, and then we also fund more of the maintenance and operations of our transit and transportation systems. Some of that is funded by ad valorem property tax revenues. That's more, the ad valorem stuff really goes more into the maintenance of roads and the operation of transit. How much fuel do we consume? Well, on a statewide basis, we consume about 9 billion gallons of fuel each year. Palm Beach County is in the top 5. We are at about a half a billion, a little more, almost 600 million gallons of fuel every year. And just a side note, so that this is all the people buying fuel, and these are the relative amounts of fuel purchased based on the type of vehicle that people are driving. This is a big deal as you look at forecasts, but I just wanted to kind of give you a sense. So you drive a large SUV, you're roughly buying 30 gallons of fuel for every 450 miles. You drive a hybrid, like one of the smaller hybrids, like a Prius, and you're only buying about 10 gallons of fuel. And if you're driving a fully electric vehicle, you're not buying any fuel.
Wanted to give us a shout out. We're a third in population, but we're down a fifth.
Yeah, that's true. This is not the rank by population. This is ranked by fuel consumption. So, those folks that and some of that is tourists. You know, the Orange County folks get a little bit higher than us because of their tourist impacts, and then I don't know, Phillipsburg is just because they're the downtown for that whole region. They collect a lot of folks, but they buy a lot of gas there.
But Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach combined.
We are the overwhelming, yes, we are the largest consumers of fuel in Florida. The South Florida region is a big player. All right, how is fuel taxed? Overall, it's about 55 cents per gallon is taxed. For every gallon that you purchase, on the federal level, that's 18.4 cents per gallon, and it's increased from 1959, it was about 4 cents, to 1993, it got to 18.4, and it stays there. It has not moved since 1993. It's not indexed to the cost of building stuff. So if inflation makes every dollar worth a little bit less, the federal gas tax can buy a lot less today than it could in 93. State gas tax is almost 25 cents. The 20 cents that goes to the DOT is indexed. The 20.7, so almost 21. The 4 cents that goes to local governments from that 25 cents is not indexed. So that means the state gas tax actually changes every year because of the consumer price index. So it goes up a little bit, it goes down a little bit. Gas tax actually fluctuates. Tenths of a cent typically are the types of changes that you see. And then at the local level, a county is allowed to levy a maximum of 12 cents. Per gallon, Palm Beach County is one of the 26 counties that do levy the maximum 12 cents per gallon. Miami, just a couple points for comparison, Miami-Dade is at 10, Tampa's at 7, and Orlando is only at 6. So that's interesting because now you've got Orange County, one of the highest fuel consumers in Florida, and they're not even taxing all the fuel at the highest amount allowed. And yet they complain about inadequate revenues in Central Florida for transportation. They have the ability to do it, and they just haven't exercised the ability. So, interesting conversation statewide. when I talk to my counterparts in other parts, some of the other major regions. On the federal side...
Can we go back to just one question? None of those categories of gas tax revenue are based on voter initiative. It's all by the... Like the county commission can vote on that. The
county commission votes...
Without the citizens...
Correct.
...participation.
That is a representative democracy decision, not a popular democracy decision.
And it's true with the state. They can, they have that formula. Where do they get their authority?
Through
the legislature.
Through the legislature.
Okay.
Yes.
Figure the local option, 6 cents, I think, they elected to do 20 years ago.
The county commission did.
Yeah, the county commission did a local option, 6 cents, which is why you see Orlando.
But this would go to like election for voters to vote on.
Correct. It's the county commissions that get to choose whether or not...
Now, can the voters agree to increase it beyond that 12?
12 is the max allowed by state law. So you, in order to increase beyond 12, you'd have to go to the legislature and say, please change the laws that allow us to levy a bigger tax. And I should mention, too, one of the things that we've done, this has been hard to get consensus of at the state level, but one of the things that we've done through the MPO Alliance in Florida is to say, let's index the local option gas taxes because we want to maintain some level of purchasing power. And I'll just mention as kind of a curiosity side note, the city of Las Vegas, Clark County, Nevada, took a very, I thought, innovative approach to generating local transportation revenue. They said, you know what, we don't want to increase your taxes. We just want to index the federal tax to what it should have been able to purchase. So they called it a fuel revenue index. And I don't know who lives in Vegas and why they don't, you know, why they don't see these things, but they call it a fuel revenue indexing. They said tax was a three-letter word that was not allowed to be used in any discussions whatsoever. They actually got the voters to approve a fuel revenue indexing law. And this was actually a voter approved, so this was a popular supported decision. They took the 18.4 cents and they increased it to, I don't know, 25 cents. So the additional 7, but they didn't give the 7 to federal government and say, go do your, they kept it locally. They just said we would have been able to do so many more good things with the money. So
blame Congress, basically.
So they've actually, and to be fair to them, and they were actually a model for some of the suggestions that I've made to the county with respect to how they're using the infrastructure surtax revenue. The Clark County folks and the Vegas DOT have really done a great job with public outreach, mapping the projects that are being built, showing the schedule of implementation of those projects that are being built with that fuel revenue indexing, making it very clear, like signage and on the roads, so when you drive by you say, oh yeah, we voted for a tax and it's building this infrastructure project. So a lot of the suggestions that I hope will be implemented by the county will maybe make that local, the recently adopted infrastructure surtax program a little more transparent to our residents so people understand what they voted for and what they're building.
I don't see an upside for not going for the full 12 cents. I mean, what is going on with Orlando, Tampa, and Miami?
I don't understand it either.
Okay.
I talked to the guy from Seminole County who's he's the chair of the Orlando MPO, and he basically said it's not politically popular to do a gas tax increase in his community. That's Seminole County, that's not Orange County, so he's on the north end. But he said it was easier for him to get a sales tax passed than it was for him to get a gas tax passed. I don't understand it. I don't have a good answer.
The 4 cents per gallon to local governments that's not indexed under the state tax who are the local governments? Is there the county government, or is this spread out in some way over the municipalities and the county?
I don't remember if I get into the details in a later slide. But if I didn't,
you have something like
it's
amounts of money, but
yeah, it's like a penny to the cities and 3 cents to the county, or maybe 2 cents go directly to the county, one gets split county city, and one gets allocated to the cities. The city revenues are harder to track, but it's a revenue share.
There's a formula.
There is a formula, and it's applied to to pennies in that 4 cents differently. On the federal side, I'm just going to highlight, first of all, that the 18.4 cents per gallon generates about $36 billion annually, but the federal FAST Act, the Transportation Surface Transportation Authorization Bill, spends $50 billion annually. So they're spending $16 billion more than they, what did I say, 36, 50, they're spending $14 billion more than they receive each year from gas taxes. That's just a side note about fiscal challenges in Washington. They're basically supporting that with general fund transfer. So it's when we say, okay, they're giving Federal Transit Administration money, they're giving federal highway money, it's not all coming out of gas tax. And that's an interesting note to make when you talk about donor states and recipient states, when we're sort of infusing money into the state, into the national program, so everyone's sort of a recipient, because nobody's giving as much gas tax as they're getting in revenues. Even after you take the administrative management of those departments off the top. On the transit side, I'll just mention, they have a capital grant program, which is the federal New Starts and Small Starts program. Broward County is a recipient of the Small Starts grant program for their WAVE streetcar, so that's a competitive allocation of funds. Local governments and areas ask for money there. They also give formula funds to all major transit providers as a portion of their overall program, and Palm Train gets about $18 million a year for funding the major capital components of Palm Train's operations. Tri-Rail also gets about $18 million a year. And they also give us some of our operations budget. The MPO is supposed to be planning for both the transit service investments and the roadway and mobility on the roadway network, the bike lanes, the pedestrians, and whatnot. And so a portion of our operating budget comes out of the FTA funds. On the federal highway side, the National Highways Program is the biggest. That's the $1 billion a year, and that's the DOT has a deal with Federal Highway that says we're only going to spend that money on the strategic intermodal system. It actually has a little bit broader eligibility than that, but DOT said we want to focus that investment, that resource, on the roads and the facilities that have the biggest impact. Surface transportation is the funds that are available to the MPOs for allocation by their own local governing board decision. So we use that for our local initiatives and our transportation alternatives program. We say the Palm Beach MPO gets about $20 million a year. Local governments apply for those funds, and we rank them against the priorities in our long-range plan. Highway safety funds, the DOT controls that money. It's $120 million a year. And these totals, I should mention, these numbers here are the totals that are coming to the state of Florida. These totals and these totals. These are not national totals. I'm trying to give you the national picture and then give you a little bit more of a local flavor. So the state gets about $600 million in surface transportation, and we get 20 of that for our local initiatives, transportation alternatives. State gets $120 million a year for safety projects, and they choose which projects they want to build with that. They've actually set aside $7 million for their Safe Routes to School program, and they ask for local governments to apply annually for that. The rest of it, they just pick projects based on the ones they've identified internally that are eligible for safety funds. Florida also gets rail and freight congestion money and congestion management, air quality money, to the tune of about $80 million a year. And then the last and smallest program is the MPO planning funds. Again, our agency's budget comes out of that statewide total, so we pay my salary and our staff, and we pay the rent to the building and whatnot. And then they also allocate a portion of the 18 cents to replacement of leaking underground storage tanks. Everyone always gets a kick out of that acronym. The LUST program is funded out of the gas tax. State portion of gas tax is 25 cents per gallon. Majority of that goes for general transportation. DOT figures out what they want to spend it on. They actually do district, they allocate most of that money to the district office and say, hey, DOT district secretaries, you know your area, figure out what to build with that fund, with that money. They do bridge replacements, and they have the county incentive grant program. So the county and cities can actually come and say, hey, we've got a great idea for your state roads. We'll spend a little bit of money if you give us the other part of the money, and we'll make it all happen.
Are these totals also statewide?
These totals are...
county grants statewide, $70 million?
I'm getting a little... Let's see. Fund amounts, I actually made a footnote here. So
District 4.
These are just District 4 totals. So the $80 million per year, the $16 million, $7 million is just in District 4, which is Broward County, Broward, Palm Beach, Martin, St. Lucie, Indian River, five counties in the district that all share those resources. Their public transit operations come out of the state gas tax, so anything they're doing, they actually give PalmTran $5 million a year to support the bus system. Then, this is an interesting one. The 7 cents of the overall 25 is actually spent, is supposed to be spent in the county where it's collected. What that means, based on the gas tax, based on the amount of fuel that we buy in Palm Beach County, is that there ought to be, and they're collecting roughly $46 million per year from Palm Beach County, but they're only spending about $30 million of it. Now, when I said it's supposed to be, what I meant is that the state law says you have to spend it in the district where it's collected, and you ought to spend it in the county where it was collected to the maximum extent feasible. So someone at the Department of Transportation has determined that it wasn't feasible to spend the other $16 million in Palm Beach County. They said there, it was only feasible to spend 30 out of the 46 here. That's an interesting one, and that's a conversation that, again, I'm having on a statewide basis with my counterparts to make sure that dollars that are supposed to be collected and reinvested locally are actually doing that, having that intended outcome. And then on that, Myron, to your point, the 4 cents, we break it apart. Constitutional tax goes to the county. That's two of the cents, or two of the pennies. The county fuel tax also goes to the county. That's $5 million. And then the cities get to split the last penny. So that's how that one ends up. On the local side, we've got the local option gas tax, which actually gets split between the county at $23 million a year, and the cities break up the $11 million remainder from that. The county uses their portion. $20 million goes to PalmTran, and $1.6 goes to engineering operations. The local option, 9 cents per gallon, all goes to the county, and they give half that to PalmTran, and they use half of it for the engineering department for running the traffic signals and maintaining the roads and mowing the grass and whatnot. And then the 5 cent local option, most of that goes to the county, with a portion of it being split out and going to the cities. And again, the county, in these dollars, they give half of it to PalmTran to operate the buses. The other half they use for road maintenance projects. So in their county road program, they actually have impact fees that build capacity, bigger, wider roads, and they have gas tax funded projects that just maintain roadways, resurface them. They actually fund, the county funds its pathway program out of the gas tax money because that's not creating road capacity. So they use gas taxes and they spend $1.5 million a year building sidewalks where they don't exist on county roads to get people to schools and whatnot safely. And these numbers are countywide totals. So that's the high level overview. I just wanted to give you the 55, the 18 federal, the 25-ish state, and then the 12 county, and how it's being used by those three entities. Again, there's a lot of places you can go from here, but this is sort of a first stab at what I thought you were hoping to get out of this.
And this presentation is a response to the requests by the members to have a breakdown of the gas tax required. Prior meetings, if anybody missed that particular meeting. So this presentation is a result of our request. Members, any questions?
Okay, good.
That was very helpful.
Yeah,
thank you. I think helps everybody.
Quite a bit. This presentation to the board every once in a while.
We should. It's, you know, we talk about it when I do one-on-one briefings, but we don't talk about it as a group very often. It's a good reminder for everyone of how we do things.
Okay.
The media should be interested in this, too.
Next on the agenda, the sunshine laws in Florida. We usually, I'll take questions just from members of the public. At the beginning of the meetings, we ask if anybody would like to speak on anything that's coming up. Otherwise, the meetings keep carrying on too long. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I'm trying to be respectful to the members that are here that are running through the time. So if you have items in the future, I know you were here at the last meeting at a minimum. If you have anything that you think that you want to comment on, it'd be great. If it's a quick question, I think we can take that just out of courtesy. Quick question?
Well, it was just a question on going back to page 7. With the widening of Atlantic Avenue by the term by State Road 7, how do they arrive at going from 2 lanes to 4 lanes?
It's not a good question.
Huh?
Yeah.
But go ahead.
You mean instead of 6
Or, I travel that road, for example. Jack's Road is so marked. It goes, as you start, let's say, from Military. You start with six lanes, then it goes by jog, it goes to four lanes, and then to one lane, two lanes, excuse me.
One lane, then.
Yeah, so you get west of the Delray Marketplace, Lyons Road,
right.
And it narrows down from four lanes to two lanes. Well, we look at, we forecast future, the number of cars we think are going to be there in 25 years. So we look at 2040 and we say, how many cars do we think are going to drive on that section of State Road 7, over Atlantic Avenue leading to State Road 7? We base that on the land uses and how many houses we expect to be built in the area, the Ag Reserve, the Lyons Road Corridor, and whatnot, and how many businesses we expect to pop up that aren't there already. We came up with a number, it was, I don't know, 25, 30,000 cars, and then we compared that to the capacity of a four-lane road. How many cars can a four-lane road handle? And if our forecast is bigger than four, we would go to six, and if it's lower than the four-lane capacity, we'd say, yeah, four's enough. In this case, the number was lower than four-lane capacity, so we said four was enough, and we want to go to four-lane road with the sidewalks to lead people to the shopping center and the buffered bike lanes to make it a safe corridor for multimodal users. And that's how we got the answer.
Yeah, so what I was doing is looking forward more, and then figuring that with all the building that's going on, wouldn't it financially be better off making it six lanes?
Sure.
And not worrying, and then in the future, you'd be spending more money.
Now we could get into the longer debate on whether or not forecasts are reliable. The short answer is we've looked out what we believe to be a long enough time frame to justify doing four lanes now and not more. So, you know, I know it's a debatable point. We can get into the autonomous vehicle issue and whether or not that'll be a disruptive technology that changes all of our assumptions. Basically, we think we've got a good answer, and we don't think that it will ever need to be a full six-lane corridor. Now, the answer changes when you go east of Lyons Road. We say, okay, people who want to drive on Lyons Road, we probably need to make that a six-lane road. It's from Lyons to Jog, and that's actually on the priority. So we said, we think a lot of cars are driving on it now,
yeah.
A lot more are coming, and we want to put that project in the pipeline. But to the west, we think four is going to be wide enough.
Okay, let's move on to the...
Thank you, by the way.
Thank you for your question. Sunshine Law, clickability.
Good afternoon, Kevin Fisher with the Palmage MPO, and I know there's a few more presentations, so I'll try to move pretty briefly, and I apologize for being such a PowerPoint, but I wanted this to kind of just serve as a summary document as well. I know a few meetings back there was a request for some more information on the Sunshine Law and the applicability to different committees and MPO board and how that works. So basically the Sunshine Law is kind of intended to keep government meetings in the sunshine, out in the open. So it's specified and described in Chapter 286 of the Florida Statutes. And it's pretty broad in terms of who is covered under the Sunshine Law. In the statute, it says any board or commission of any state agency or authority or any agency of any county, municipal corporation, or political subdivision. We do have in our committee bylaws for our technical advisory committee, our citizens advisory committee, the BT PAC as well, adhering to the Sunshine Law as part of our committee bylaws. We have reached out to the county attorney in the past, who has also confirmed that the Sunshine Law is, that the committees are covered under the Sunshine Law as well. So I did want to do a little more research. The state attorney general's office has a pretty user-friendly website where you can do search of different topics, and it'll bring up all the rulings that have been made in the past. So the one that seemed most applicable was, this was related to a request from the Hillsborough MPO, because they were looking to form a joint citizens advisory committee between Hillsborough and Pinellas, in addition to the citizens advisory committees that each individual MPO had. And in a response to that request from Hillsborough, then Attorney General Charlie Chris said, this office has previously concluded that citizens advisory committees appointed by an MPO are subject to the provisions of Section 286, the Florida statutes. So such a requirement would also apply to any other board or commission or subcommittee that an MPO were to form. And the JCAC is that joint citizens advisory committee. Briefly, the scope of the Sunshine Law. It's equally applicable to elected and appointed boards, and has been applied to any gathering of two or more members. And what's important with that is that's why we say there's an item that's either on the agenda or likely to come on a future agenda, no member-to-member discussions are to happen, because then that's technically a meeting that's not, hasn't been advertised and it's not open to the public. So that's meetings of public boards or commissions must be open to the public. Reasonable notice must be given. All these committee meetings are advertised. Minutes of the meeting must be taken and promptly recorded. And I think, like we've mentioned in the past, all the recordings of our technical advisory committee, these committees, are on our website. So at any time, anyone can go to hear and see the agenda and all the presentations that were given at the meeting. It's a little hard to read. I can share this with you all. This is just a copy of the form. If there's ever a conflict of interest, typically this would be if, an example would be if you were a property owner and you were going to be voting on a new transportation project that would provide access to that site. Well, you would stand to gain financially from that. So that would be a case where you would need to recuse yourself from that item. And then there's a pretty simple form that you would submit specifying why you recused yourself from voting on that item.
Are copies of that form available at meetings?
Yes, and we can email that out to you. We have a PDF, so if there's ever a situation that arises, we could print that out and bring that in so that can be filled out. But yes, we can share that. Just generally speaking, the Sunshine Law is meant to ensure that all meetings of boards or committees are open to the public. The members do not engage in conversations about any items that are either on an agenda or may come before a future agenda. And it applies to discussions and deliberations of boards and commissions, whether formal or informal. So just in summary, what it means for you all is do comply with the Sunshine Law. If you feel like you have a potential conflict, identify that at the meeting and then recuse yourself from voting on that item. And then do not discuss current agenda items or future agenda items. And if a citizen advisory committee member has identified a potential conflict of interest, you know, outside of the meeting, don't talk about that item with that member. Presentation is available on the website, so you can click, but if you want more in-depth details, or if you have any other questions, that was from the Florida Bar, a pretty good overview document, and gets into more specifics of the requirements of the Sunshine Law. So that is all I had. But any questions?
I have only one question.
Yes.
The restriction of conversations between two or more members of the board about substances on the agenda, does that include what the agenda would include? That is, we approve the agenda at the beginning of a meeting.
Right.
So we can't, send an email to Greg and say, I'd like to have such and such on the agenda of the next meeting?
No, you have to send it to Alexa or somebody,
right.
Somebody with the MPO.
Correct. So we coordinate through staff, and then staff can work with the chair on the agenda setting. But right, I wouldn't go and reach out to another.
Okay.
Where you bring up like the last item that was for discussion that we asked for was
right.
Again,
it's requested within this meeting. Exactly.
In fact, do we even ask for a breakdown? What's the Sunshine? You know, are we subjected to it? Subject to it?
Right.
Or not?
Right.
These are both follow-ups as to our discussion.
Exactly.
Does anybody else have any comments on the Sunshine Law? We all know we have to comply.
So we can be friends and socialize and go to parties together. We just can't talk about anything that's on the agenda.
Exactly.
Well, it may be on the agenda in the future.
Exactly.
Just like, oh, well, I have this agenda. We can't talk about these things.
Right. Things that could foreseeably come before the...
Hopefully a party in my temple.
Seriously.
Yeah. Just
yeah.
To tag on what you said there at the end, you also can't use a third party. So you can't tell someone maybe outside of this group, hey, I'm going to support this and that or something, and have that communicated to another member of this board. So you can't communicate directly or through a third party.
In other words, we come in total ignorance.
Yes.
Can't discuss anything,
yeah.
And are just asked to approve what the staff puts in front of us every month.
That doesn't include a citizens not on the board, right?
Right.
Correct.
Correct. We can talk to you about it.
And you hope you do. I worked under the federal Federal Advisory Committee Act for 30 years. And it's not nearly as onerous as the state law. It's really onerous, the state law.
Yeah, I think Florida has among the strictest.
We also got a kind of a reputation, though. So, I mean,
this did stem from previous actions of certain
individuals. But how did it prove the reputation?
All right, we'll move on to the next item. Item D, the US 1 multimodal corridor study kickoff.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Valerie. I'm the multimodal manager at the Palm Beach MPO. I came to you guys a couple months ago and to talk about this study that we were just starting on. Now we're actually getting ready to kick off the public outreach. So I'm just going to give an overview again of the study, the goals, the timelines, and next steps from here. So this is a study that we're looking at US 1 from Camino Real in Boca Raton all the way to Indian Town Road in Jupiter. And it's an MPO priority project. So we're trying to connect facilities along this corridor. It's a really busy corridor and a big project. So it's 42 miles, crosses 14 communities, and it's Palm Trans' highest bus ridership in the entire county of all its routes. So, it's not coming here last night, too. So, it's a busy place, lots of destinations along the corridor. However, there's some areas that have good facilities, sidewalks, bicycle facilities, nice transit stops, and there's other areas that are missing sidewalks on one side of the road. They're missing bicycle facilities. You can see up here, this was like in Lantana, where the lady's waiting at a bus stop. It's just a bench with a pole, and she's sitting from there. It's just gravel and bushes, so you know, good luck getting there. So we're looking at the corridor as a whole and trying to connect these facilities. So, and also trying to get communities to think about the corridor as not just a street and a neighborhood street or a street in their city, but looking at this at the big picture, that this street connects to the north and south of you. And because there's been a lot of different little studies happening or people wanting to do a study on this street, or even missed opportunities, resurfacing projects. So the entire corridor is DOT owned, so that's good. So we're dealing with, you know, one owner. But they go in and they say, oh, we need to resurface this mile of the corridor, and we're just going to go in there and do that. And so we want to be able to have this plan where we say, no, we want to put in a sidewalk, we want to put in a bicycle facility. So as part of this plan, we want the results, the recommendations to be implementable. So we're looking at, within the right-of-way, what could we do with what we have today, and we're going to create a continuous plan view of the corridor so that you can point to anywhere in the corridor and say, oh, this is what we could do here to improve it. And again, connecting the bicycle and pedestrian facilities and upgrading and expanding the existing transit service. So currently, I mentioned Palm Tran. It's Route 1 and the Bolt limited stop service runs on US 1. The Bolt runs from West Palm Beach to Boca Raton during an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening. And then Route 1 runs all the way to Palm Beach Gardens. But we want to create a vision and a plan for enhanced corridor bus rapid transit all the way to Jupiter and figure out where would enhanced bus stops make place to put them and create a vision for a branded buses. So right now the buses look the exact same, the Bolt looks the exact same as Palm Tran. The bus stops might be a pole in the ground, it's not really very attractive. So we're trying to create that vision for corridor based BRT. And we're looking at community health, safety, and economic development. So that we're doing our first health impact assessment. This is something that other MPOs like Metroplan Orlando and other agencies across the state and the country are starting to incorporate. So looking at other factors beyond what you typically look at in a transportation study. So looking at chronic illness rates along the corridor, obesity rates, looking at economic development, what else is happening? What about access to healthy foods? Where are there, what is the different factors that we wouldn't always generally look at? And we're bringing in health partners to help us feed in information and data for these improvements. So we say, hey, you know, this would be great if we connected this sidewalk here because actually kids need to walk along here and they need to get to school. There's a grocery store over here, they can't get to it now. So that'll help feed into the study and building a case of, you know, why we should do these improvements and where. So we have three consultant teams working on the study. Kinley Horn's leading the bicycle and pedestrian improvement roadway analysis. Kittleson is and associates are leading the transit analysis and health impact assessment. And then Treasure Coast Regional Planning Council is helping us coordinate the workshop charrette locations and stakeholder interviews. So in each section of the corridor, we're doing stakeholder interviews with elected officials, business owners, city staff, different stakeholders there. So the project timeline, in the spring we started this doing some research, and now we're getting ready to kick off this month, kickoff event this Saturday in Boca Raton, just the informational booth with our transportation partners about this study, and then starting this workshop charrette process throughout the quarter, all the way through October. In the winter we'll work on creating the report with all the findings that we gathered through all this process, and then in the next spring we'll have the final report and share that. So here's the entire corridor from Boca all the way to Jupiter, and we've divided into six sections. So section one, Boca, is where we're starting this month in May, and then we'll be moving into Delray, Boynton Beach, Gulfstream, and the other communities all the way until we reach Jupiter in section six in October. So if you live around this year, this corridor, will be coming to you soon. So some of the preliminary things that we've looked at so far through the health impact assessment is we were looking at households without access to a vehicle, concentrations of that along the corridor, as you can see here on the right. And then also we found that in comparison with the county as a whole, a lot more people walk, bike, take transit, carpool, and work at home along this corridor than the rest of the county as a in comparison. So that was interesting. Also looking at kind of what's happening around the corridor, so 13% of county residents work along this corridor, and then 19% of the county jobs are along this corridor. So a lot of people coming to this corridor, up and down the corridor, living here, working here, so a lot going on. Looking at demographics, where are the minorities, looking at what's just kind of the characteristics of the corridor. And then income and poverty, where how does that look along the corridor? Also, I mentioned transit, so we have 8,600 daily riders are along the corridor right now, 18 routes connecting or running along the, connecting to the corridor in addition to the US-1. And so half of the transit riders today are transit dependent, so they don't really have another choice. They ride transit because they have to. So, you know, if we make this better for them and for everyone, you know, we're really getting a win here. Another thing that's interesting, we're looking at where are the bicycle facilities missing along the corridor and where are the sidewalks missing. So I mentioned sidewalks are missing in Lantana, Hypoluxo, some of Boynton Beach, and you know, we have a big chunk that's missing bicycle facilities, which unfortunately happens to also be the areas where that we were looking at where the people need it the most, the people that don't have access to a car, that they're trying to get to work, there's nothing for them to go. So those are things that we're looking at. Also biped crash data, fatalities, where have those occurred? Again, you kind of see a pattern, especially, well, up here we see where we were missing facilities. And then we have some more to the south. We're also some crash hot spots from the ped bike safety study we did recently. So that's kind of where we're at right now. The next steps is we're kicking off this public outreach. We have this event with information on Saturday, and then we'll be doing these charrettes and interviews May through October. And then working on the improvement analysis. So again, here are the sections and what months will be in each section. And then right now we're doing stakeholder interviews in Boca Raton section one, and the workshop for this section will be on, not this weekend, but next weekend on Saturday, May 13th, and then an open studio charrette Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, where anybody can stop by at any time. The teams will be working on the analysis as people come by, working on the design and getting input. So come by, and then on the last day at 4 p.m. there'll be a closing working presentation of all the feedback that's been received and kind of the results that have been concluded in that section. We have a website up now, so you can go visit the website for more information. We have a comment map that you can go to that map, drop a pin where you think there should be an improvement and a comment. So really hope to get your comments through that. And we have a Facebook page where we're posting these charrettes and the different events and news happening. And then make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram for the project. So that's kind of it. Wanted to give you an update in that we're gearing up to with this outreach process. So we look forward to your input and your participation.
Thank you. Any questions, Jerry?
Yeah, well, just out of curiosity, that section you were showing about the sidewalk gap in Boynton Beach on the west side, isn't that because the FEC road right-of-way, their track right-of-way is right up against US 1? I mean, can they feasibly put a sidewalk in there? Because that's been a discussion for a long time.
So that area right there is within their right-of-way. The track isn't like right up to the sidewalk, so the track might be over here, and then like there's bushes over here, and there could be a sidewalk where there's gravel. So it's within their right-of-way, so we need, and we're actually talking to FDOT right now because they were going in to do a resurfacing project, and we noticed how bad it was there. So they're looking at getting an easement. That conversation's happening with them because they've done that in other sections of the corridor, but it's missing their...
an easement from FEC?
Yeah, so they have to pay like kind of rent to put in a sidewalk to connect those transit facilities and to have people be able to, you know, walk up and down the corridor. So that's a discussion, but it's something that, you know, could occur.
Good luck.
Any other questions? Okay.
I think this is really wonderful. I hope we will get to see a progress report sometime. That just struck me that all the threat businesses is between May and the fall, May and October. Some portions of US 1, I would think that they're not insignificant, or the portion of the population is seasonal. But that portion of the population will not be reached by this. Are you trying to compensate that for that in some way?
Well, we'll bring that up when we're doing, so we're interviewing the elected officials in each area, the commissioners, the mayors, the key city staff, so economic development, planning directors, engineers, all those folks, and we're asking them to spread the word about this project so that even if you're not here and you can't come to a charrette, you can go to the website and provide your comments and learn about it to all their contacts. So that if they have email lists of some sort of an association or a group of people or a CRA, hopefully, you know, if you live in a neighborhood and you get that flyer and it's sent out to everyone, you may not live there, you only live there seasonally, maybe you'll get, you know, the word out to them. So
I think it's a wonderful job, all the presentations that we've been having, and then the advancement that I've seen the MPO have in technology in the presentations we receive over the last few years. One thought I had, though, is we're having like the charrettes, but we're also having Sunfest. I mean, is there something that we can do? Because nowadays it's so easy to get a tablet where you just put on a few slides that people can actually flip through themselves, put in their email address, that would have information that would interest the general public, that we could then do, you know, start to go into some of the forums where the more of the general public is going and might actually flip through that, and we could have like an MPO staff that gets into Sunfest for free.
We did have some staff volunteering to help with Bike Ballet. We're trying to create a survey there and get input out. I know it gets kind of crazy, especially with the Bike Ballet. We haven't really thought about, but we can look into the iPad concept. For this weekend, we are printing a bunch of business cards with the website, Facebook, and whatever QR, QC code, and a brief description of the project, so we can bring some of those to Sunfest and some other events, too, to tell people, hey, this is happening, check it out, follow us on Instagram, on Facebook, write your comments. So.
Interesting. Yes.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to jump back on the agenda because we need a motion to approve the minutes of April 5th, our last meeting. hopefully these are warm here coming up on 3 o'clock, and then we start to push our timeline. And a motion.
So moved.
Okay, motion by Andrew, second by Judy. Does anybody have any additions, comments, deletions on those minutes? Seeing none, I'll call the question for approval. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Okay, we'll go back to the information items. We have one left, which is the challenge. Your regional commuter challenge update.
Yeah, so last year we did a commuter challenge. This year, FDOT through their program South Florida Commuter Services is leading a regional commuter challenge during the month of March, this month, which is actually also National Bike Month. So this was our challenge last year. It was really successful, and they decided to do this something similar regionally, and it'll be all the way from Monroe, so Key West, if you're commuting for a meeting there, all the way to St. Lucie, to encourage people to take transit, carpool, walk, bike for their commute. So this year, one thing that's exciting is that they developed an app. So if you create, you go onto the app, you can log in and log your commutes for which way, which mode you're taking, and that'll be tracked. Also, they're working with local businesses, so depending on where you're at, the app will say, oh, you're in downtown West Palm Beach, and you'll get prizes from local businesses, so like a free coffee or something will pop up for when you're logging commutes. So that's pretty neat. And this is the website, it's sflcommutes.com, where you can learn more about this challenge, and you can sign up and download the app. There's lots of partners participating in this challenge, so we hope that you guys will help us spread the word and also participate. And that's kind of it. This is, I'm just kind of giving a presentation for them because they couldn't come, but basically trying to you know, track that data, encourage people to participate, and there's some flyers at the table in the entrance. If you have more information, you can contact them about it.
Thank you. All right, last on any comments by anyone? Not? Okay, thank you. Last item, the summary points of the MPO meeting. Anything you want to highlight there, Andrew?
No, it's been the packet there.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, but nothing to discuss. Okay. Any member comments? Get you out of here. Okay, the next meeting is June 7th, 2017. Can we have a motion to adjourn?
Yeah, you got it.
Motion to adjourn. Is that really